Thank you for joining us this evening. George Norrie is off. And if you'd love the chance to meet with George in person, you could do it tomorrow, March 10th at 5 p.m. at the Jeannie Wagner Theater in Salt Lake City, Utah, where he'll be joined by Jason Martell, Danyon Brinkley, and Nick Pope. You can see George in person, be a part of the Q&As with each one of the guests. George will also be singing a few songs with a live band. You can get information by visiting coasttocoastam.com and clicking on the events tab. Or if you want to buy tickets, they are going quickly and there's only a few that remain, give them a call at 801-355-2787. That's 801-355-2787. Or visit artsaltlake.org. That's artsaltlake.org. And get out there and see George tomorrow. Tell him you heard about it on tonight's show from Dave, passing that information on to you. And if you like the best in overnight talk radio, then I encourage you to check out my show, The Best in Paranormal Talk Radio, Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. Along with my co-host and producer, Tim Dennis, we explore the strange and unusual world around us, from ghosts, UFOs, Bigfoot, psychic phenomena, monsters, myths, legends, and more. All the information is right on our website at darknessradio.com. That's darknessradio.com. When we return, Nick is still here with us, Nick Redfern, to talk about the Slenderman mysteries and internet urban coming to life. And we'll also be joined by Bill Murphy from Sci-Fi Channel's Fact or Faked to talk a little bit about the Tulpa situation and what these are and an ongoing experiment he's been working on. We'll do that in just a few moments when we return to Coast AM. The Slenderman mysteries, an internet urban legend, comes to life. Nick Redfern, our guest. Now, Nick, as you point out in the book, when I did the show, I was speaking with a guest from Sci-Fi Channel's Fact or Faked, right here on Coast to Coast AM, the night before or the night of the Slenderman attacks in Wisconsin. We were talking about Tulpa's thought forms and talking about some of the experiments that have gone on. With Bill Murphy, and Bill is joining us online now as well. Bill, thanks for popping on for a little bit.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dave, and hello to you as well, Nick.
Hey, Bill, how's it going?
Things are good. Thank you for asking.
All right. Now, I wanted to have Bill pop on as well because, I know you're always fascinated by the experiments that are going on out there, Nick, and Bill, you've definitely been one of the people in the forefront testing these theories on Tulpas and what we can do, where are these creatures and beings coming from? And you and I have talked about things like the little girl's spirit on the Queen Mary, which we think, or at least I believe, is probably more likely a Tulpa than it is a spirit of a little girl hanging out on a ship where there's no records of the death of any children, let alone drowning children in the pool. And that has led to an experiment that you've been doing. Do you want to give people a little bit of information on that?
Sure. And, both of you guys touched upon it earlier when you were speaking of the Philip experiment. So between some local haunts that you mentioned, Dave, and locations that have ghost lore associated with them, but you can't find the really origin of the story, the Philip experiment is one that has intrigued me for quite a long time, and I was interested in how Philip could have manifested in the physical space that Iris Owen and the rest of the Toronto Society of Psychical Research were in. It was behaving like a poltergeist, so it was knocking, the table rapping and knocking around. So how did that happen physically? So I looked like really the methods that they used to create Philip. And just to elaborate a little bit on what Nick said, it really had a tragic ending to Philip's story because, yes, Philip was an aristocrat, had a grand estate, but he was married to his wife, Dorothea, all fictitious, and Margot, the woman that he had an affair with, was then accused of being a witch and was burned at the stake. Philip then committed suicide by jumping off the wall of the estate. So now his ghost would haunt that location. So that was the storyline that they created. And then Philip started to reveal additional storylines when they would ask questions that they didn't write. And so he seemed to be like a tulpa, broke free of the creators and started to have communicating independent with thought, his own thought, even though he was apparently a thought form. Well, Philip was abandoned, and when you listen to the interviews with Iris and the rest of the team, they said that by abandoning Philip, because they felt the experiment had gone as far as it could, that even though he was created as a ghost, but then moved into the physical world and almost taking on a real life, by abandoning him, he then took on his intended role of becoming a ghost, where he remains, according to Iris's last interview. Well, all of that really intrigued me, and so what we did, and Dave, you happened to be present when the experiment was done in 2007 at the Glen Tavern Inn, and not anybody was really hardly aware of what we were doing. We being just six of us that created the history for Pearl, was the name of the ghost, at the Glen Tavern. But I wanted to have an equally tragic life and end for Pearl, to attach an emotional component to her. So, you know, Pearl was a madam that was working in the brothel, and the brothel was real, but Pearl was not. And so we wove Pearl's history into the actual history of the Glen Tavern. And if you recall, in 2007, they had little plaques along the hallways and had tidbits of the history that were real, but one of the plaques was fictitious. It's the one that we wrote about Pearl. And so attendees, at least I was hoping, would be able to record sounds associated with Pearl that we wrote into her storyline, and those the sounds of the pearl strands that she would spin and they would clack, and the coins that she would cascade into her hands and they would click together. And so if there were unusual sounds like that, then perhaps we could maybe make an association, or maybe not, depending on where these sounds were being recorded. Well, we did this. Some people became very critical of it, and Nick, you know, I think he sort of touched upon this. You know, by creating Pearl, we also created Pearl's murderer. And so the criticism I got was like, you didn't just create a victim, a tulpa perhaps that would be a victim, but you created an evil entity as well, if all of this is even possible in the first place. Remember, this is all highly experimental. Now, I wanted to make this physical for those present to see if we could alter the space. And so, Dave, you may or may not remember the photo that was taken, or the black box itself, which is really was created to bond everybody in the room. So we passed this little mechanism around. It was sealed. It had LEDs. It does have some moving parts and other components. But really, by passing it along, I was observing what was happening with it, and people were speaking to each other in a group. And normally, if you have a big conference, a lot of people are there independently that are there, but it's not like a group conscious per se. And by passing this between everybody, some people would hold it to their cheek or to their chest because they could feel it moving. They would speak about it. And so I thought that this was perhaps joining the group as one, as Nick referred to, as maybe creating a hive mind. And I had hoped that I could have gotten some results at the end of that conference. But I wasn't the organizer. Like you, Dave, I was invited to attend this conference. But what happened is that one of your conferences, Dave, at the Stanley Hotel, I was giving a presentation on spirit photography, particularly with the use of mirrors, when an attendee there at the conference approached me afterwards. And he said, "You gave this talk on spirit photography with mirrors. I'd like to show you some photos." He went to his room, got a binder, started flipping through it, and there's this photo of, you know, this double mirror, which is in the lobby of the Glen Tavern. I said, "Where was this photo taken?" He says, "The hotel in California, the Glen Tavern Inn." I said, "Please, let's exchange numbers. I can't talk now, but I need to follow up." Well, I followed up, and the photo matches the description of Pearl. So I know you asked Nick earlier, is there any scientific proof, or, you know, is manifestation, is it, can it become physical, or is this just a sort of a mental manifestation? I would think that perhaps otherwise, that maybe these tulpas, and thought forms can manifest. We got an image that can't be explained. I brought an LAPD forensic photographer to try to replicate the photo, and he could not replicate it. No matter how you stage that lobby, you cannot get a person to appear in the mirror and not be in front of the camera. But in the photo, there is no one in the lobby. It's just the reflection in the mirror, and you see the cameras flash behind her. So it's a mysterious photograph, matches the exact color, matches the images that we used, because like Philip, they drew Philip. We got images that we wanted Pearl to be representative of, and she was a conglomeration of stereotypes. And the image matches. So to answer your question directly, Dave, and that's a long answer, but you know, how do we do it? I actually broke it down into steps, and this was enabled by what Iris Owen and her team did. And really, if I could break it down just a few quick steps, I'll just mention them right now, if it's okay.
Please.
All right. So we imagined the personality. That was step one. We wrote the history that surrounds this apparition. That was step two. We added the details, so like a biography around the person to sort of bring the individual to life, so to speak. The fourth step was kind of critical. We wanted to compel this thought form to exist by affirming its existence through, it looked almost like a reverse seance. So it was a bit of a conjuring episode that took place, and not everybody is too keen to doing that, but that was what we did. But instead of conjuring an entity that you would then try to control, we were just trying to conjure a thought form into existence that had no prior history. Number five is attempt to communicate with this entity. And then six, record the results. And finally, present the findings. So it wasn't until I met Jim Spann, the photographer, that now we had a photograph that perhaps was the end result of this creation of Pearl.
How does that affect you as somebody who's running an experiment like that, Bill? I mean, Nick, we're talking about thought forms, the idea that these things may exist, and all of a sudden we've got somebody now who planted the seed of an experiment in 2007, and years later somebody's photographing a room where this creature, this being was created, and there's photographic proof of this being existing now.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, this is the sort of thing we need, going from just sort of discussing things from a theoretical perspective and actually, you know, having some degree of reality and evidence to it, you know, to show that there is something going on. And I think, you know, you made a good point before the break, Dave, when you actually said, you know, terms like supernatural, etc. I think, you know, the time will come probably when, if we do understand one day what thought forms actually are and how they come to be, that it'll probably be something that'll be explained, you know, by a form of science that, you know, we just don't know the answer to right now, you know, so it gets passed off as it's magic or it's the occult or it's the paranormal. But it may have a, you know, a rational answer that it just eludes our science, you know, in the early 21st century.
And Bill, when you're setting the standard for this and you're creating, and then all of a sudden photographic proof comes back of your creation, how does that impact you?
Well, to sort of answer that and address what Nick said, I wanted to understand the mechanism. What is the physics behind this? How could an image appear as a reflection and not appear as a physical body in the room? Because, you know, the mirror is just bouncing photons back and it's reaching your eye, and, you know, there you're perceiving the image, the light that's coming in, but there was no originating light for the photograph. And so I really started the research and dig into that, and I ran across a presentation, and eventually I became a student of Dr. Claude Swanson, and is very interesting physicist. He's got a series called Synchronized Universe, and in there he discusses, one of his books is called Life Force, The Scientific Basis. He discusses how an entity and a ghost and the sort of physical manifestations could occur, and he explains it with the fifth force of the universe, And, you know, there's the weak and the strong nuclear forces, there's electromagnetism, and there's gravity. And so this fifth force is torsion fields, which is twisting action, and it distorts space and therefore light. And that's how these images could possibly be created, through these torsion fields. Well, you know, Eve, you can have a heavenly body. You can have the Earth, you can have the moon, you can have stars. Their twisting action will certainly have an effect on the surrounding area through these torsion fields. But I dug deeper into the Society of Scientific Exploration, the SSE, and there were other physicists that claimed that the human mind creates this twisting motion as well, and it could possibly bend light and move objects, which is psychokinesis. And I replicated I took the white paper for two of them and replicated everything. I mean, we spec'd it out using all the exact components to see if we could create pendulums that were mounted. These aren't little simple pendulums. These are big, sort of industrial, heavy pendulums. See if you could create a spinning action on them. And when everything is dampened, there's no seismic activity, no thermal flow, no wind flow. So I had to totally get a place that was completely isolated from the ground, no wind, nothing. I had sensors everywhere, and there is no environmental factors that could explain what we were doing, but we would wish this pendulum to spin. And it's about the size of maybe 14 inches across. It's got some weight to it. And you look at it, and you desire it to spin, and it begins to spin. And so we have cameras on it, and we're measuring the movement on it. And while the person is visualizing it moving, so you're not necessarily looking at it. You can look at it. You just have to think about it, and it would move. So the physicist that discovered this discovered it by accident when he was staring at his birdcage, and it began to spin. And why is that happening? So he's one of the first ones that created the experiment, and then other physicists then replicated his work and got the same results. I brought in some people from the SSE to see if we could recreate the experiment, and we got the same results. So it's like unbelievable to talk about, but when you experience it and you see it happening, you see that psychokinesis, moving objects, perhaps moving photons of light, and them forming an image becomes more realistic.
That sounds a lot like these psychic developers that talk about cloud blasting, where they'll go out and stare at the clouds and make like a gun with their finger, and they'll point and shoot and blow clouds apart. I mean, it sounds like you're having that same kind of physical effect on an outside item. You know, I mean, you've got it going on simply by the conscious decision to make it happen.
Yes, with the exception of a major difference that if you're looking at, you know, a cloud, and it's cloud busting is kind of the slang phrase for it. If you're doing cloud busting, then you don't have control over the environment because, you know, there's thermal flow and there's breezes that's happening all the time. The moisture is accumulating and then breaking apart. So if you stare at a cloud, it'll move and it'll become, you know, Mickey Mouse if you wanted to. Or just blow holes in it. And so that will happen over time randomly, kind of like a lava lamp will just move in the shapes. But if you remove all those other factors that could influence, say, a cloud, in this case, we'll use the pendulum as the example, the platter, and then you can still make it move, and it's mounted, and it's stationary, and there's no environment that could interact with it, then there has to be this another force that's causing it. And so that's why the only one that I am able to fall back on that has any sense of being rational is Claude Swanson's. And it's not just his theory. He just writes about it in his book, Life Force. And so that's where I first became aware of it, and that's why torsion fields are of interest to me, because it could explain what appears to be haunting and poltergeist activity, and perhaps the photograph that we spoke of with Pearl.
Bill, thank you very much for calling in and being a part of the show with us. Nick Redfern's going to stick with us for the remainder of this hour. We're opening up phone lines. We'll take your calls. If you have thoughts on tulpas, have you had your own experiences? What do you think about Slender Man? Is this being something that's now part of our world, or has it always existed? And now that we're giving it the attention that it wants, it's making itself known. We'll talk about that when we return here on the Best in Overnight Talk Radio. For George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Thank you very much for joining me. Hey, I'm going to be participating in a new TV series about people who've had experiences in hospitals, paranormal experiences. They're looking for more people to share their stories, doctors, nurses, patients, security workers, anybody who's experienced anything paranormal in an active hospital, hospice, nursing home. If you have a story to share like that and you're interested, you can email your contact information and a short blurb about it to me at dave@darknessradio.com, dave@darknessradio.com, and I'll forward it over to the producers. If they're interested, they will get back to you, but you may be featured prominently on a new TV series about hauntings and haunted hospitals. Again, you can shoot me your story and contact information to dave@darknessradio.com, and I'll make sure to pass it on to the production company. I'm going to be going out to Romania this year, and we've done these live trips every year. We've had listeners from our show and Coast to Coast join us as we go out and hit the road to see haunted historic sites around the world. This year, we're going to be visiting with Romania, following in the footsteps of Vlad the Impaler. We'll get a chance to investigate a few of the different castles, paranormal investigations, haunted Baisu Forest, and more. You can find information on my website at darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. Not only that event, but all the other great places that you can see me and my co-host Tim Dennis at throughout the rest of the year. We'll be back with Nick Redfern and your phone calls next here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back. Nick Redfern, my guest for the remainder of this hour. Nick, are you ready to throw open the phone lines? All right, let's hit it. Wildcard line one, Charles in Elgin, Texas. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello there, David. Boy, it's so good to hear the way you're talking about this this sort of thing. It does point to bigger issues. One that I hope that you'll kind of be able to discuss in the second half of the show with an open line. But it seems like here we are. We're kind of we're in a situation where we're being in a new reality where we're kind of remembering, our power as creator, and it seems like here we got the Slender Man and all that. And sometimes I think we can also affect the past by our present, by what we're doing in the present. So the my issue. My question for Nick. I mean, Nick does a lot of things to make things real too. When he writes about something, or he writes about whatever it might be. I don't know if he's written about time travel, but that's kind of my issue. I want to make that more real in this reality that we're in. But the thing is, I wonder when he writes about Slender Man, or when anybody creates any of these characters or let people know about these sort of potential realities. I wonder how much we're kind of creating these realities that we think we're. I mean, here's one important thing.
All right. Well, hold on one second. Do you have an actual question for Nick? You said you had a question, and then it just keeps going. I want to make sure he can address it before our time slips. No problem.
Yeah. I do have a question. I mean, how much do you think? Let's see. Science is sort of the game of working things out, figuring stuff out. And when people, of course, once you figured out everything, then the game's over. But so that'll never be over. The fun of it will never be over. But so I wonder how much all these efforts to prove things by science, like the effects of tulpas and all that. I mean, have you done any kind of, does your writing include any kind of, acknowledgement of the fact that we're increasingly able to create these realities? And
Well, that's actually a good question, because, if the human mind can sort of focus on something like a Slender Man and create it, whether it's one person or multiple people, then you could make a good case that if somebody reads a book and becomes, you know, really deeply interested in the character or one particular story, and they spend a lot of time afterwards thinking about that particular chapter or that character, then arguably, you know, you could achieve something very similar. You know, there's not much, if you think about it, there's not much difference between obsessing on an image of the Slender Man, you know, on your laptop versus reading about something in a book. In that sense, you know, I mean, you could kind of suggest that just the act of thinking about something that is in a book could potentially tip the scales and start off the creation of some sort of thought form. So, you know, there's, as we heard with Bill, you know, a different way as well of sort of bringing these things into being, and with the Philip experiment and things like that. So I think whether it's a book, whether it's a movie, you know, a comic book, whatever it is, I think that's less important than the process of actually creating these things. But, you know, if you've got an image in your mind from a book or a TV show or whatever, you know, that would strengthen, I think, the belief and the ability to create a real-world version of it.
Thank you very much for calling in. Here's an interesting email, and I think they mistook your point on this, so I want to give it a chance to be voiced and have you kind of answer to this. It says, the girls that attempted to murder their friend because of Slender Man had serious mental health issues. For your guest, you or your guest to suggest anything else is beyond disrespectful to the girl that was stabbed. The girls who perpetrated this senseless crime are sick with diagnosable serious mental health conditions that require medications to regulate. For your guest to suggest this crime had anything to do with anything other than the two sick girls with an undiagnosed mental health condition is wrong. Those girls, because of their health, were susceptible and vulnerable to fictitious things they read or saw. If it wasn't Slender Man, it would have been Mickey Mouse or a voice they heard telling them to hurt somebody or themselves. That's the way mental illness works. Well, I think she's misinterpreting what you were saying and what we were talking about. We were discussing why black-eyed kids phenomena and Slender Man didn't really kind of go the same way. We said, well, one was because it was being taken more literally and people were taking this creation and suddenly treating it as though it were real. And that there's no question these girls have a mental issue and that they are desperately in need of medical help for this. And we in no way want to diminish the victim's anguish that she had to go through on this. We were simply, at least I was, bringing up the fact that the way that some of these creatures are perceived by the mainstream and by, you know, people in the paranormal community is, you know, maybe the reason Slender Man got so much more attention is because it leapt to the actual news pages because of stories like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, if people go back and listen to the archive of this tomorrow, they'll see that when I was talking about that, I actually did say that some people take the view that this is purely an internal psychological thing on their part, you know, and other people, I was being truthful when I said, there are people who do believe that the attack by the girls did have a supernatural component. There are people who believe that. That's what I said. Now, one of the reasons why some people do believe that is because, as I pointed out, there have been reports of tall, slender, dark figures in that area on previous occasions, one of them being, as I mentioned, one of the guys in the book, Mike Huberty. He had an experience in the 1990s. So, you know, that is one of the reasons why people, or some people, look at this particular angle of the girls and the attack from a different perspective than it just being, you know, something to do with a mental illness or whatever. Some people legitimately do think, with the other strange stuff going on around Waukesha, that it isn't the full story. Now, you know, I mean, there's no, like, as you said, Dave, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, the court came to a decision, and as I said, they'll be behind, you know, out of society for decades. And there's no doubt that they fully believed in, you know, what they were looking into in terms of the slender man. But as I said, yes, there are two schools of thought, totally different. One, that it is due to mental illness, and the other one is the idea that it was, you know, it was connected with something else. I mean, bear in mind that one of the girl's mothers did say that her daughter had seen something like the Slender Man years earlier. That's not me putting words in anybody's mouth. That actually came from one of the mothers. So, you know, in other words, that's why for some people there is a grey area. For other people, there's no grey area, and it is just mental illness.
All right, let's go to first-time caller Adam in Johnson City, Tennessee. Welcome to the show. What did you want to share with us?
Hey, thanks, David, for having me on the show. I just started a job a couple of weeks ago where it's a third shift job where the majority of my job I'm actually driving in a car just going from about 2 or 3 in the morning. I remember I was having trouble staying awake, and I was sitting there trying to think. I was praying and everything. I was like, God, I got to stay awake. Please, like, send something to keep me awake. And I remember this gray face, and all I remember was the face, and it was like a gray figure, and it had black eyes and like a black divot where the mouth should be. I didn't see any kind of eyes or anything, but I just remember it passed through me, and I woke up instantly, and I was awake for the rest of the night. I just couldn't even think about going to sleep after that.
And how long ago was this?
This was about 2 weeks ago.
Well, that's freaky. So you've seen a similar character to this Slender Man.
And see, I've never even heard of the face described
right
before until the night when I was listening to the show. And that face, I mean, when I heard him describing that face, I mean, I just had to call because that was almost the exact kind of description that I saw.
It's interesting because my kind of first connection to this faceless creature came from a personal friend who had a car accident driving. And she and her husband got to an intersection, and they saw this car come creeping through the intersection in front of them. It was a T. And the person driving behind the wheel turned to face them, and it was just this blank, flat face. You know, there was no eyes, nose, mouth. It just turned to look at them. Later on that evening, when they got back to that intersection, they were T-boned by a truck that had gone out of control. And so, I mean, there's some of these weird aspects of it as well. Now, have you heard stories like this, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, that's a classic example of, this phenomenon, sort of the face that actually isn't really a face, so to speak. But again, you know, what this demonstrates is that people are seeing something that very, very closely resembles a fictional creature, the Slender Man.
Thank you, Adam.
Again, whether people, you know, accept these accounts or not, the fact is they are out there, you know, and I've got a lot of them. And I don't personally think that, you know, like, for example, right now, you know, with your caller, things like that are hard to deny. You know, when you've got somebody rationally and lucidly telling a story of something that happened to them, and, you know, it ties up very closely with the Slender Man. And so, again, you know, whichever way people look at it, there's a phenomenon. There's no doubt about that. And that's, you know, when not the last caller, but the person who left the message, that demonstrates the whole issue of the Slender Man. Is it this or is it that, or is it somewhere hazily between the two? You know, and that's not a case of me, you know, having my cake and eat it, so to speak. You know,
right,
as I said, there are people who have one view on it and other people who have another on it. My view is the thought form angle, and I think it has merit to it, and the more that it gets discussed and talked about, the more it becomes in the public domain, and it goes on and on and on.
Let's go to Wildcard Line 3, David in Flint, Michigan. What point did you want to bring to us?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Nice to meet you, Mr. Schrader, and you as well, Mr. Redfern.
Thanks.
Thank you.
My is an experience. Goes back to about 1977, 1978, in a town about 12 miles from where I live. They were having some sightings of what was supposedly a Bigfoot. Well, as the local sheriff and the law enforcement found, it was a man wearing a Halloween gorilla suit. And it was easily debunked, but the people were still, after this was highly published, that this was a man in a gorilla suit, the people were still seeing dark, hairy forms in the woods. There was one rumor of someone actually shooting at what they thought was a creature, and one getting into someone's garbage. And years later, I went to college and studied psychology and was thinking about studying Carl Jung and the collective unconsciousness. And I was wondering if I got to thinking of, did this phenomena, was it started to link in everybody's minds to create either hallucinations or archetypes that people believe that they were seeing something that might have been there or not? And then in reading Mr. Redfern's book on the Slender Man and tulpas, I was kind of, it struck me in the same form that maybe it wasn't a single person that created this, but a group of people in an area were able to form something that caused these people to see something like this.
Well, thank you for weighing in on that, David, and we appreciate the call. Nick, I'll let you wrap up with that as we have about a minute and a half left together in the segment.
Well, one of the interesting things about what the caller just said is the fact that, you know, somebody running around in an ape suit. I actually do have a couple of cases, not in relation to Bigfoot, but actually to other types of creatures where people have, we know somebody has fabricated something, somebody's absolutely hoaxed something. But in the immediate weeks afterwards, people claim to have seen something identical to the original hoax, you know, the original created hoax, as if, you know, in the period in between when the hoax was carried out and in between the period when it was shown to be a hoax, when everybody was sort of, you know, running around town and trying to find out what this monster was, in that period, everybody really was focusing on it. And even though, you know, it was kind of shown to be a hoax, people reported something pretty much just like the hoax. Again, as if, you know, just the act of planting the seed in people's minds that there's a monster out there, you know, that might explain some of these very weird Bigfoot-type reports where people claim that the creatures vanish before them. You know, they never end up getting shot and killed. And of course, the skeptics say, well, that's because they don't really exist. But on the other hand, you know, you could make the argument, what if because people believe there are strange things in the woods, that it gets kind of embedded in our subconscious, and, you know, we believe, or to some sort of subconscious level, that there are monsters in the woods or in the lakes, and so we create them, but we can never catch them because they're not really flesh and blood animals. They're sort of born out of the mind.
Interesting stuff. The Slender Man Mysteries, an internet urban legend, comes to life. Nick Redfern, our guest, thank you for being with us. Stay tuned. We're taking your calls next. It's open phone lines. Let's hear your creepiest tales and experiences next on Coast to Coast AM.